Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome back to another adventure in history in 2022. I'm just going to keep saying it so that we keep
you like saying
getting
that,
used
don't you?
To it. Yes, 2022.
See, I'm old-fashioned. I write checks.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have written it cleanly every time.
Oh, good. Good for you.
I don't know. I made the turn very quickly. I think I wanted to.
I was going to say, put those other years behind us.
That's right. Last week we had the fabulous curator of the Clatsop County Historical Society, Dr. Chelsea Vaughn.
She was great.
And she talked about two exhibits, one that's already up, though it was ever evolving
yes.
and ever changing. The blocked out race and place in the making of modern Astoria. And two things. I have to give a shout out to a secret radio pal of the week, Barbara.
We love those radio pals.
And she not only came in to see the exhibit, and then she listened to the radio show. She sent us a very nice email talking about the exhibit and what she liked about it.
Yeah, it is. It's really interesting. You know, one thing that I took away from that, Chelsea said that when she starts to curate these exhibits, they actually start years before. I mean, she said this one was 4 or 5 years prior to really starting to put it together here. That's a lot of thought.
Yeah, this one time. Actually, this mm-hmm. one, there was a casual conversation that she and I had about 3 years ago. And this sort of evolved from that through her, not like us continuing to talk about it, but we talked about something somewhat similar. And I was like, hey, do you think we could ever do this?
Mm-hmm.
And we had a long conversation about it and we chatted with some other people. And then we just kind of let that boil for a lot while, and then she kind of shifted a couple of degrees over and came up with this.
Yeah, but the amount of research that she put into it is pretty amazing. So check it out, and you can check out that podcast too, because she does do a great job of explaining why there is so much information and how she got that information to make it, to really tie it into what is fact.
And that's one of the tough things. You know, we do something that I'm very proud of. The Historical Society does CumTucks, our mm-hmm. quarterly historical journal we've been doing for at least 1,010 years, I think, maybe more like 40 something. But one of the things I always caution when people want to do research with that is we let people write like, this is what my grandma told me.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make it fact just because we published it.
It's stories.
It's hearsay, mm-hmm. and there's probably truth there. It's probably accurate, but it is somebody's memory that they're talking 30 years later. So I always caution people that it's a great resource, but don't take it as fact. And that's one of the key things that Chelsea talked about, is that we're only putting into this exhibit things that we can document.
Mm-hmm.
So things that we know, not just hearsay. Like, I heard that this happened back in 1910. Unless we can document it was in the paper and there was another, you know, corroborating story, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's great. It's good. So check out that podcast and then come check out the exhibit too.
Okay, so today's show, we were supposed to have a guest.
We were. We won't name names.
We're not going to name names to protect the guilty. like Dragnet. Names have been changed to protect
the guilty. Forgot about us.
I think.
How could you forget about us?
I think this person did forget.
I think so too.
And you were diligent. You asked a month ago.
And I then, did, but I think I asked then, too early.
And then sent a reminder, but like a week ago, a reminder.
Right. So, we do often book out a month, but that can be a problem. So
we had a long discussion before going on the air about what is the proper amount of notice to be a guest on an adventure in history.
Yes.
We're still not sure.
We're not.
But apparently for this particular person, a month and a week is not the right timing.
But stick with us, folks, because we still have material.
We do, because we had something really neat that we didn't get to.
Yeah.
Once before, we'll do the this day in history or this day in tomorrow's history.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to set up the whole explanation that we were not quite fully prepared. But we left. Remember a few weeks ago, actually it might be like a month and a half ago now. It was around Thanksgiving time.
Mm-hmm.
We did letters from Clatsop County people serving in World War II. And we had only really done the European theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we had sitting here by our microphones the Pacific Ocean front. So we're going to talk about some of those because those were fun and we had nice feedback. People told us they were pretty interesting. And some people recognize some of the names.
Oh, fun.
So that is always fun. So do we have anything we need to get to before the big history highlights?
You know, I did miss a special occasion earlier this month. I miss the Mac Burns Day. And Mac Burns, who sits 6 feet away from me, didn't even remind me.
Well,
not that you should, but it is a day, and it's a day celebrated here in Astoria, folks.
By dozens of people.
Well, maybe just a dozen, because I saw the photo,
yes.
A masked photo of about a dozen people who celebrated Mac Burns Day.
Well, see, January 6, 2012, yeah. It was Mac Burns Day, and then we have celebrated the anniversary of Mac Burns Day.
Yes. And maybe your family celebrates your birthday, or do they celebrate Mac Burns Day?
Well, both, of course.
Okay.
But see, the reason I didn't make a big deal about it, A, we had a guest
week
that we should have talked about it.
That I should have talked about it.
Well, I don't. I'm shameless.
I was graciously called out very publicly about this.
Yes. But the problem, too, is twofold. One, we're now 10 years removed, which is why I don't say we're celebrating Mac Burns Day. We're celebrating the anniversary of Mac Burns Day.
Got it.
But, of course, it was January 6th, which has been kind of ruined now.
Right. That's true. That's true, too.
And for two reasons. One, obviously, but the other one, a very personal reason, is that a very close friend of my family's passed away last year on January 6th.
Oh.
So this was not an exciting year to look forward to, the one-year anniversary of losing this friend.
Right.
And they were not an older person. They were actually younger than us and
yeah.
should not have died. They had a long life that they should have been in. Looking yes. forward to. So it was kind of somber this year.
Okay.
So maybe next year we can be a little happier about it.
Because, yes, like I said, I was called out, and that, you know, it's on my calendar now that it's going to show up every single year.
Well, I know somebody locally who is a friend of the organization and a friend of the city whose birthday is January 6th. And I kind of remember that now, because when I first learned that, I said, oh, my gosh, you're what a great day. You're born yeah. on Mac Burns Day. So I kind of remember, and I send her a text first thing in the morning.
Oh, nice. Well, that's good.
And I'm sure she just thinks, oh, I saw it on Facebook. But
well, now you know, folks. So it is a day in history. We're not going to say how many years ago, unless Mac wants to share.
2012. Yeah. See, what I liked about the first time is usually when the by mayoral proclamation they make somebody's, you know, this day, it's the day of the city council. So
right.
like you show up there and the day's over. And for some reason, the city manager's assistant, she said, I just kind of thought for you, we would put it 3 days out. So instead of like the Monday night, January 6th was Friday that year. And she just kind of knew somehow, some way that things were going to boil up. And somehow somebody made a big 8x10 of my face.
Yep.
And those were plastered all over town. You walked around downtown and shop windows had them in the front and on mannequins and things. And it was very silly and very funny.
Yes. And people now just put them in front of their face for a picture.
That's
a little
right. All right. Well, that's embarrassing enough. Got anything else you want to embarrass me?
Nope. Nope. That's it.
All right. So these are things that happened tomorrow, January 17th.
Yes.
The big history highlights, and again, these are things you can just talk with your friends and coworkers to seem like you know what's going on in the world. 1916, a group of professional and amateur golfers at the Taplow Club in New York City form the PGA.
Wow.
The Professional Golf Association.
That's a good one.
1929, Popeye makes first appearance in the comic strip Thimble Theater. I'm not a big Popeye fan.
Eat your spinach.
He seems like he's an addict.
he's not around anymore.
And then there's Bluto that's like eating hamburgers all the time. Is it just, I don't know. Let's see, 1950, the Great Brinks robbery. 11 men rob $1.2 million in cash and $1.5 million in securities from the armored car company Brinks offices in Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, didn't know that.
There's a movie, too. 1953, the Corvette is unveiled at GM Motorama.
Nice.
I have never owned a Corvette. I've ridden in one. I don't really have a strong sense one way or the other.
Aren't they small?
They seem very small.
And short.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Very low to the ground. 1954, Jack Cousteau's first network telecast.
Oh.
He airs on Omnibus on CBS.
Nice.
Jacques Cousteau.
That's a good one.
I wish I could do an accent, because I kind of want to try to imitate him right now, but I don't think I would even come close. It would sound more like Pepe Le Pew. Look, here is a fish. I don't know. 1961. This was almost going to be my history highlight of the day. President Dwight D. Eisenhower delivers a televised farewell address to the nation 3 days before leaving office, in which he warns against the accumulation of power by the military-industrial complex.
That's, yeah.
And it stays heavy on our minds since 1961. And that phrase right. is used all the time, too. 1966, NBC greenlights The Monkees.
Oh, fun.
and which was your favorite monkey?
Oh, that's before my time.
You have not formed an opinion?
No.
Davy Jones, Michael Nesmith, the guy with the hat?
No.
Okay. I liked Mickey Dolenz. He was the wacky one. Let's see. 1991. Operation Desert Storm begins with the U.S.-led coalition forces bombing Iraq during the Gulf War. So I have a little side story on this. Mm-hmm. 1991, I was just graduating from college, and I worked for a senator, a U.S. senator. And that was my first day of work.
Oh, my goodness.
Was January 17th, 1991. And all I did the entire day, they threw me on a phone, and the phones would not stop ringing.
Oh.
And people were either saying, "About time, and bomb Saddam Hussein's butt," to, or people would be saying, "This is horrible. No war for oil." And we had just a big tally sheet. Yes, no.
Oh, my goodness.
We were supposed to just try to get the people off the phone as fast as possible. And then we were calling it in. I was in a home office. I was not in the Washington, D.C. office.
Okay.
And about every 2 hours, we tallied and would fax down to Washington the tally of here's what the locals are saying.
Interesting.
My entire first day, just nonstop from 8:30 in the morning until 5 o'clock.
What did I sign up for?
Yeah. So I always remember the day I started because of that. And I also remember when Operation Desert Storm started because of that.
Right.
1995, NFL Rams announced their move from L.A. to St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Didn't
remember that. 1997, Ireland grants a divorce for the first time in the country's history. 1997.
Unbelievable.
Divorce. When I started reading that, I thought like, oh, gay marriage or something like that.
Good Catholic.
Civil unions, but no.
Catholic.
Straight up just
country,
divorce.
Country, yeah.
But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact on history, 1920, the first day of prohibition of alcohol comes into effect in the U.S. as a result of the 18th Amendment to the Constitution.
That's a big one.
So today, no more alcohol.
Can you imagine?
So what'd I miss?
You missed a good one.
What'd I miss? Oh my gosh.
Tomorrow is Betty White's birthday.
Oh,
I know.
Betty White.
It's a little bittersweet, but I
so close to 100.
I do think it's very sweet since she just passed away at 99. And you know, one thing that I was thinking about was how did she look the same
for the last 30 years?
For as many years. 40
years.
So I was looking it up. And so when she was on Golden Girls, she was 63, mm-hmm. but she was playing a 55-year-old.
Wow.
She was the young one on the Golden Girls.
Yes.
And so she, you know, at six, not that there's a huge age difference there, but I just think that that's kind of interesting too. I wouldn't have even thought she was 63 just because she just seems so ageless and she did look the same.
Yeah.
So, yes.
For 30, 40 years.
100 years ago, tomorrow, she was born.
That's amazing. All right. So, again, these were letters that were being written from afar during World War II from people that lived in Clatsop County and they were serving. And they were writing home to mom or dad. Or sisters, brothers, and then those family members were taking these letters and giving them to the local newspapers
yes.
in Seaside, in Astoria, and the newspapers were printing them. So, you know, people once upon a time cared about their neighbors.
Yeah, I think this is I think it's because I was asking you, where did they or how did we get these? So from the public newspaper. And so these folks knew that mom or dad were sharing these. Too.
Sometimes.
You
know, sometimes they were just writing, "Hey, mom, hey, dad, here's what's going on." And they weren't necessarily. But we also, from the ones we read in Europe, we know that sometimes they were being clipped and sent. And like, oh, here's another one then, since you printed the last one.
And as you said, some folks will recognize some names. So we just also want to just pay some respect that these were real people,
mm-hmm.
real stories. And they're sharing, they're often young men for the most part. There's some young women. Just a little taste of what's happening in their life to bring a little bit of normalcy back home. So just keep that in mind as we're sharing some of these stories.
And we may suddenly pause as if we feel like we need to edit on the fly a little bit if there's maybe an inappropriate word because they're in war
sure.
and they're not going to necessarily talk about the enemy in the politest of terms or the most politically correct terms. So let's see. In the trenches, the South Pacific, Chuck Elroy of Seaside wrote his parents about the invasion of Palui. P-E-L-E-L-I-U. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. September 15th, 1944, early in the morning, I stood beside the rail of the ship and looked across the horizon to a group of small islands, which seemed very quiet and peaceful. This being the day we were in, were to make the invasion, it made me shiver all over, for I knew that sooner or later I would be over there fighting. While waiting for the hour in which we would strike, I could see our mighty naval ships sending heavy barrages into the island to help soften it up. Besides naval fire, there was tremendous bombardment and strafing from the air. Soon the hour to strike came, and all the landing boats filled with troops headed for the beach. I don't remember which wave I went ashore on, but we went in just before we hit the beach. The Japanese set down a heavy stream of mortar fire, which covered almost every inch of the beach. Heavy fighting took place on the airfield, but the fighting spirit of the Marines pushed the Japanese back. All of their big guns were knocked out by the air attack, so we weren't bothered much by artillery fire. There were a few tanks to put up with, but they didn't last long.
Private First Class Stanley E. Tapp from Seaside remembered how it felt to be attacked at 4 o'clock in the morning. He and his company were guarding a road in a long river valley that had been used by the Japanese as a supply route. I was in the back of the machine gun position in a foxhole when they came at us. I heard them yell, "Shoot 'em, shoot 'em." I didn't have time to get scared while it was going on, but afterwards, I was shaking like a leaf. Lieutenant Martin A. Vanderberg, formerly in charge of the U.S. Naval Radio Station in Astoria, wrote his wife from Tararut Atoll in the Gilbert Islands, "It was not expected that my outfit of radio men would do any fighting, and accordingly, we were scheduled to come in 4 days after the island had been captured and do our work. But the terrific battling lasted longer than expected, and we got here before the island was completely clear. For the first few days we were here, there was some sniping, some resistance left, but the Marines quickly cleaned it up. Now everything in the nature of danger from them seems to be wiped out. However, I did learn the meaning of foxholes and have experienced the ping of ricocheting bullets while safely in my foxhole. Of course, all the inconveniences of camp life, such as the bad-tasting distilled waters, catch canned meals, K-rations, which are really good, the dust, dirt, the dead and wounded prisoners, and worst of all, the stench from the dead, which was all part of it. Mm-hmm. Never in my life have I seen such devastation as exists on this island. They put up a terrific fight and went down fighting to the end. They had many pillboxes and fortified bomb proofs, which were tough to knock out. I really have to give them plenty of credit to the Marines. Great dust clouds rise continuously on the island. The heat is terrific. At night it rains and blows and one gets soaked. Then it gets cold and one looks eagerly for dawn. There remained on the island cats, one with its ear shot off, a few puppies, a couple big pigs and two little ones. One hen and one rooster, and I just had to mention these things. A little black and white kitten is climbing on my knee and seems happier to be with us
than with the Japanese. How funny. I think maybe you're projecting.
Yes, maybe. But,
Gilbert Bailey, a resident of Seaside, was stationed in the Philippines as an army mail clerk in 1945. When he wrote this letter, "After a long, hot, tiresome trip, we finally arrived at our destination, the Philippines. It was rough the first few days, and I wished I'd never been born. I was so sick. We reached the tropics in about a week, and it was there that I began to long for my home in cool Seaside. I lost 21 pounds before I set foot on land. We are stationed in a large city that was once as beautiful as it is now ugly. You would have to see it to believe it. You can walk for hours and see nothing but rubble, charred and black, that often carries the stench of bodies buried beneath, and heaps of stone and ancient metal. Typical is the Hall of Justice, with tall pillars and carved figures. The front is smashed as if a giant hammer had crushed and pounded it to bits. Strangely enough, the people have taken it all in their stride. They have begun to clear away the rubbish, and is business as usual for them." Bailey's attention then turned to other aspects of island life. "There are thousands of homeless families and no end of orphans. They live everywhere and sleep where night finds them. There is always some of my chow left over for my pet orphan, a little fellow, about 9 or 10. We call him Pete, and he will be a friend for life. Sleep is impossible without a mosquito net. They sound like a P-38 and have a sting in proportion. You can be sure of having a bed full of ants each morning. You don't mind the black ants, but the red ones have a bite that draws blood. Roaches are as big as mice, and they can drag a whole slice of bread. Ugh. Lizards are everywhere. We find every kind of rodent, insect, and reptile in the stacks of mail. They are drawn to the food in the parcels. I never thought about that. Now and then, we come across a tarantula. No one has yet been bitten. Okay, as if war isn't bad enough.
Yeah.
That does not paint a pretty picture.
No. Two Astoria men, Wally Y. Chung, radio man first class, and George J. Haru, chief carpenter's mate, were active in one of the most, quote, romantic and dangerous episodes of the war against Japan, according to an article from October 1945. They were members of a naval group known as the Rogers, the Sino-American Cooperative Organization, or SACO. At first, the organization gathered weather and intelligence information, then evolved into a dangerous fighting outfit, blowing up trains and raiding Japanese outposts. The SACO Americans became adept at Chinese disguises and slipped through enemy lines when they chose. Their activities extended all the way from Indochina to the Gobi Desert. Bill Haig of Clatsop Plains earned his Bronze Star fighting as a guerrilla behind the German lines in France and the Japanese lines in China. He was awarded for 31 successful operations. This is the story as it appeared in March 21st, 1946. It all started in the summer of 1944 when Haig transferred to the OSS from his outfit, the 82nd Airborne Division, in which he was serving as a lieutenant. He, with 30 other Americans and a lot of equipment, was dropped behind the German lines in France to help organize and direct a unit for the French partisans. They did not last very long, Haig relatives relates. We had time for only four major operations before we were overrun by the United States Army operating from the south. Our party attached itself to a band of about 200 French, according to a plan devised previously to the operation. We operated southeast of Paris. Our operations were usually ambushes in which we would trap German troop or supply convoys. We had good luck. It was a different story in China. We were dropped in teams of four, with my party put down on a railway and highway running from Canton to Hankow, about 30 miles north of Canton. The four of us were attached to about 120 Chinese whom we attempted to train for guerrilla work, unsuccessfully. But at that, we were able to do a lot of damage, blowing up a number of bridges and staging a lot of successful ambushes. And we had a lot of narrow escapes. All in all, we'd made such pests of ourselves that the Japanese decided to do something about it.
Uh-oh.
Early one morning, we suddenly found the tables turned on us. We were hunted rather than hunters. Before our sentries gave the alarm, we were surrounded on three sides by about 1,000 Japanese. On the other side was a high and very steep mountain. I would have sworn that no one, not even a mountain goat, could have climbed that mountain. But you should have seen us get over it. The Chinese took off first, and we were not far behind. We were constantly exposed to the fire, and we lost about a third of our men. But no Americans were hit. We have long since thrown away our uniforms and were wearing the dress of Chinese peasants.
Wow. I think we often forget about the Chinese part of World War II, because they were our friend. A Marine Corps combat correspondent, Sergeant Ed Meager, wrote about the death of Marine First Lieutenant Julian E. Leonard, age 23, of Seaside, who was killed in action on Orot Peninsula on Guam, leading his platoon into action. Meager interviewed several of the men in Leonard's troop who said, "We hit the beach, and he got us organized in a hurry. You never had to look very hard for Lieutenant Leonard. He was right with you all the time, and there was no mistaking him. He was 6'4" or so, a very good sight to see in combat." See, I don't want to be bigger in the combat.
Right,
I want to be a smaller target. He gave the men confidence somehow, just watching him and knowing he was on our side. You know what the point is? The three or four men who precede the main body of the platoon. Well, Lieutenant Leonard was leading the point that day. You can see why the men idolized him. A day or so later, he was pinned down by the Japanese, and a man was pretty badly wounded. Leonard asked for a couple of volunteers and got them. It was plenty hot right then, bullets and mortars whistling and booming all around us. The lieutenant took the volunteers, and the three of them lugged the wounded man back to the aid station. He said the company on our right was in trouble and that we were going to move over and help out. We moved over, and what a scrape we moved into. Lead was flying thicker than coconuts. The lieutenant was everywhere, sticking his head up to get a line on the Japanese positions, crawling around, deploying his men, and leading us in a series of attacks on the positions. I saw him go down, a shell fragment, I think it was. He must have been killed instantly, for he was dead when I reached him. But the rest of us held that left flank. After the lieutenant was killed, we were so mad, we'd have stood off the whole Japanese army. You know, things like that you read and you just think, okay, this is like some Louis L'Amour book or some crazy, but this is firsthand and this is the way they're remembering it.
Yeah, living it. Don Larfield of Seaside wrote from the Philippines, 3 days ago, I was assigned to the infantry. So far, it has not been too bad. We are dug in on a hill, which we must hold. There is fighting all around us. The artillery is pounding away and we can hear the shells whistle overhead. Some are landing only a short distance from my command post. Transport planes today are dropping supplies to some units, and we can see the artillery observation planes all day long. We do a good job. The bad part is the rain and the mud. It does not take long to turn everything into mud, and it just stays that way. My foxhole is a mud hole. We could not cover it completely, so the rain got into it. I look like a bum. I have not shaved in 3 days and don't plan to for a while. I'm going to see if I can grow a beard. I've decided to grow a goatee and let the mustache develop into the axe handle type. I'll be fine soon if some colonel does not make me shave it off. A few days later, he wrote, today I gathered some rainwater in my helmet and shaved all except the goatee and I am growing. I look very dignified with it. I had to rebuild my foxhole and I hope we can keep the rain out of this one. We're having a little sunshine this afternoon, although it rained this morning and it is still muddy. Larfield did much more than bail water out of his foxhole and trim his beard while the shells whistled overhead. He was a platoon leader and made many trips out of the jungle to fight the Japanese. He wrote, I've been on more patrols. Day before yesterday, I hit a Japanese dug-in position with one heavy machine gun and two light guns protected by rifle fire. They started to surround me, so I had to withdraw fast. I went back later with a larger patrol and cleaned them out. We killed 11 before they got away. Conditions had changed considerably months later when he wrote, I suppose you know by this time I got my commission. It's okay being an officer, so far anyway. I have an orderly who cleans up my tent, makes the bed, and does the laundry. It's a good deal after having done all this myself for the past 4 years.
Okay, so the you stumbled on the Van Dyke beard.
Yes.
I'm amused by that because it's not a term like I remember very often, but it's just funny.
I didn't know what it meant, so I skipped over it.
It's a style of beard.
Style.
I like that he's shaving while there's artillery going all around him. I just can't picture, I've seen a lot of footage, both World War II and, of course, now in 24/7 news, we see what guys go through all the time. But I just can't imagine.
Well, and the just, trauma of it all, too, right? Yeah. I mean, he's writing this to mom or dad about killing 11 people.
Yeah.
But to him, it's worthy of writing and sharing because it's the day-to-day. I mean, you just think of what happens, you know, and we know now when people come home from that.
They have to desensitize themselves.
Yes.
I remember I interviewed once a guy who was one of the landing guys on D-Day, one of the gunners in those landing ships. And as they were approaching, he could look down and see all the guys standing there. And you could just hear the pinging of machine gun fire against the front. And about halfway to shore, the guys in the front realized this door is about to drop and all of us in the front row are going to get it.
Yeah.
And he said after the first drop, he would never look down again because he didn't want to make eye contact knowing these guys are going to die in 3 minutes when we hit the beach.
Right.
And I mean, I interviewed that guy when he was 70 and he still teared up talking about it.
Yeah.
So, well, gosh, that was kind of a downer to end on.
Yeah.
Sorry, people.
But a big tease to next week to our special guest who did call halfway through the show.
Yes. So. I heard pinging and looked down. So
he's not lost.
We'll try again next week. But that's why we had these. We knew we still had the Seaside stories to
get.
Yes. So thank you all for listening. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for an adventure in history. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.